Hello, everyone. I'm John Melke, and this is Parkside Today. I'm joined by Dr. Franny Mann, Assistant Professor of Chemistry and a member of the UW Parkside Chemistry Department faculty. Dr. Mann, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So growing up in Wisconsin, I knew that we grew cranberries. The state grew cranberries. And anyone who has driven the western portion of Highway 21 in Wisconsin has driven right through cranberry bog country.
Correct.
I did not know that Wisconsin is the leading producer and processor of cranberries in the nation.
It is true.
Amazing. Your research is, some of your research, is involved with the cranberry industry. And rather than me describe what you're doing with your research and going way off and not having it even close to correct, if you would tell us what that research entails.
Sure. So as a little bit of a background, I am a products chemist. I'm interested in the compounds that are made in fruits and vegetables, basically made in nature. And cranberries are rich in a type of antioxidant called anthocyanins.
Okay.
Those are what makes the cranberries red. So they're really, they're common in any berry or on the skin of a red apple. You would recognize that as being a red pigment, those anthocyanins. And one of the things that is interesting about anthocyanins is it's a growing market. They're strong antioxidants. They have all these applications, neuroprotective applications, applications in helping with our cardiovascular system.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all of those supplements are currently made from food products. So if you've ever gone to the store and bought cranberry juice, well, the way that we make the supplements or the pills that contain anthocyanins is we take cranberry juice and we dehydrate it.
Oh.
And that seemed like a waste to me because I also know that we have tons of those compounds in the skin and seeds of the cranberries. And if you've ever seen some cranberry pulp, it's very, very red. It has lots of extra anthocyanins, residual anthocyanins. And my thought process was, well, what if there's a way to get those out of the skins and seeds in a way that we don't have to be using the same thing that we already market to people? We can use this waste and help the cranberry processors monetize their waste stream.
Sure.
And the cranberry processors were incredibly keen to this idea. As you can imagine, they're running businesses. They're trying to keep their margins as good as possible. And they said, really, you think that we could do this? And I said, you know, let's try. So I worked with a few cranberry processors, and we spent the year kind of testing different methods to get those anthocyanins pulled out of the skins and seeds. And that's the basis of the research.
So Recently, you did a presentation and talked about your research with a group from WISIS. And during that presentation, you talked about the need to process, if I have this correct, the need to process cranberries fairly quickly.
Yes.
And so rather than growing in Wisconsin and then being shipped to somewhere else to be processed, they're processed right here as well.
Yes.
So why is that time important?
So the peak harvest is actually this time of year. So you might go to the store and you'll notice that this is really the only time of year you can buy fresh cranberries in the grocery store. And they degrade pretty quickly. I mean, I don't know how many times I've brought home other types of berries like raspberries or strawberries. And, you know, I didn't eat them quite quickly enough and they get moldy and then they're bad, right? Cranberries do the same thing. So the processors actually freeze them immediately and keep them in giant warehouses so that they can continue production all year long.
Wow.
And in terms of efficiency, cost efficiency, that makes the most sense for them because we can send them on a truck to a different state to be processed, but the odds that they go bad increase with every hour they're not being processed. So many of these cranberry processors are actually both growers and processors. So they co-ops effectively where the farmers will have the cranberry bogs and they'll sell to a very specific processor who processes only their cranberries and then they split the profits at the end of the year. So Badger State, which is one of the cranberry processors we worked with, works like that. Some of them are more national, like you might recognize the name Ocean Spray or Mariani Dried Fruit, which you can buy in the grocery store. But they still work directly with their own farmers. And as soon as those cranberries come out of the fields, they're getting processed, and then they get frozen, and then they can continue to be processed for the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm. What was happening to, after the cranberries processed, and we have the pulp and the seeds and the skin, what were they doing with that?
Sure. So there are a few cranberry products, and it kind of depends on which cranberry product we're talking about. So we could talk about juice, and that's maybe one that people recognize. With juice, there are a lot of residual waste components. I mean, we have the skin, we have the seeds, and then cranberries are pulpy. Part of the reason you can make cranberry sauce at home and it thickens kind of without your interfering with it just by boiling it a little bit is because it contains a lot of something called pectin. And pectin is a natural thickener. It's, you might recognize it, you know, if your mom or grandma made jams or jellies, you buy like these pectin packets and you add them to the fruit to thicken it. So cranberries are incredibly rich in that, and really doesn't have a ton of nutritional value. We can't use it. So those types of foods were largely getting dehydrated, maybe used as animal feed. And some of the processors actually worked out deals where they had basically a zero cost waste stream where feed manufacturers for hog and even dog feed will take those cranberry skins and seeds and peels, and they'll incorporate it as antioxidants into animal feed. And all it's doing in animal feed is preventing spoilage.
Okay.
And so the feed.
So it's preventing spoilage. Is it there? So the, like in the animal feed, they're not, the animals aren't getting any benefit from the antioxidants that are there, or not as much?
It is possible, but for the purposes of the feed producers, they're not terribly interested in that. I would say they tend to be more interested in shelf life.
Yeah.
So, and that's part of the reason that the waste stream cranberries are perfectly fine for that. If you were more interested in adding nutritional value, you'd probably add whole fruit or crushed fruit.
Okay.
And so if, I don't know if you have a pet or not, but I have a couple dogs, and in kind of the higher end dog foods, you'll see they have blueberries and cranberries and stuff like that. But those tend to be the whole fruit, not the juiced, you know, waste product of the fruit. So when I say that the feed producers are interested in antioxidants for anti-spoilage, they're really not too concerned about the food additive benefits of it. Although I'm sure they're not complaining if it does help the hogs and animals do better.
Right.
But so this zero cost scenario, the feed producers will actually provide a truck to the cranberry processors at no cost. And the cranberry processors would dump their waste in the truck and it would get hauled off and get incorporated into animal feed. But the cranberry producers weren't making any money.
Just breaking it.
Just
here
they
it
didn't
is.
Have to pay to dispose of it.
Right. Okay.
And so when I went to them and said, "Hey, I think we could probably do something with that waste. That we might even be able to send the feed producers or other users." I guess another application was compost. They took the cranberry seeds and peels and made it into kind of a fertilizer, effectively. It's not a very good fertilizer, but it's better than nothing. So any of those applications, what if we took out some of these anthocyanins and we could use them for human consumption and provide you a new, you know, profit-driven stream for your waste? And then what if we could even put it back into the waste stream? So when I take out the anthocyanins, what if the rest of the skins and seeds, the other components, the pectin that I described, what if we could still use that for compost? And that was actually one of the aspects of the research that we did follow up on. And it turns out that after we processed these skins and seeds, we could still use the rest of the waste for compost if the cranberry processor wanted to do so. So it was really only value added at that point, as opposed to, you know, taking one waste stream instead of another.
So if, so in the process of extracting more of the antioxidants, does the what's left over from the processing of the cranberry, is then that not as interesting to, let's say, the animal feed producers, that then they're not using it, and you say it's using it for compost?
Right. So I don't know that we checked with the animal feed producers, because that wasn't a way that the cranberry processors were able to monetize their waste. I don't think that they were terribly interested in continuing. I think that they figured if I built a company off of this, I would have to dispose of any waste I didn't use. And they were like, she'll deal with it. Yeah. Won't be a big deal.
Yeah.
We did check for the compost because they were able to monetize that. So they were able to get a little bit of money when they did send it towards the compost route. And we were able to confirm that the things you look for in compost are carbon to nitrogen ratio. We were able to confirm that we didn't significantly alter the carbon to nitrogen ratio. So as maybe questionable of a compost source as cranberry peels were to start with, I don't know that it was a great option, but it was, again, better than nothing. We didn't make it any worse. And so in that case, we would definitely be able to then help those cranberry processors kind of get double the income off of the waste. But one thing that we could follow up on in the future is asking the feed producers if they could still use it.
After it's done. We're talking with Dr. Franny Mann, assistant professor of chemistry here at UW-Parkside, talking about some of the research that she's been doing that involves the cranberry industry here in Wisconsin. Dr. Mann, when you're doing what your research and looking at it, extracting the antioxidants from what's left over after the processing of the cranberries, what is that process of doing the extraction? Can you tell us about that?
I can give you a little bit of insight, although we did apply for a patent on the process, so I can't give you too many details.
Sure.
So one of the things I'm interested in is how microbes, that would be bacteria, yeast, mold, fungi, things like that, interact with natural products. So my initial idea was to see whether we could add some food-safe bacteria and fungi to the cranberry waste, and maybe those microbes would digest away all of the things that were currently retaining the anthocyanins. And that would allow us to extract those anthocyanins into a water-based system, much like the juice I described earlier. So that would be safe for human consumption. I don't know if you can appreciate this or you know this, but I mean, we have a huge fermentation industry in Wisconsin based out of the cheese and dairy industry where we make all of these cheeses and yogurts. So we actually have many fermenters. We've got MillerCoors working in Wisconsin. So we have this great basis for doing that in Wisconsin. So I figured it wasn't too much of a leap to apply it to another big Wisconsin industry. And so these microbes, if you're selective with them, if you choose the right ones and the right amounts, we were able to optimize our scenario so that we were getting over 10,000% improvement in extraction in anthocyanins. And you have to believe me, John, I had my students check that number about six times. I didn't believe them. They brought it to me the first time and I said, no way.
No.
That's not real.
Go back and do that again.
And then did it again. And then I said, I don't know if I believe you. And then they did it again. And then they brought me the raw numbers and I did the math myself and I said, okay, you win. And they, it was incredible. So now we are enriching water to be anthocyanin rich, and that can be used in many, many industries depending on what your end goal is. But that's the basis of the process. So it's very green, very built on industries that are already strong in Wisconsin. And the most exciting thing for us is that the cranberry processors thought this was something that they could actually do. So one of the future goals is we're going to try to get a little bit of USDA funding so that one of my partners in the industry can build a little prototype within their existing facility. And so we, you know, kind of like you go to the store and buy baker's yeast to make bread. The idea is that I would provide them with this, you know, proprietary mixture of bacteria. And then they would add it to their waste and basically have a little, you know, kind of like when you brew beer in your house or something like that, the little tank that they ferment it and then pour off this anthocyanin-rich liquid. And that's the vision we're moving forward with. We're hoping to see if we can get funding this spring to get that kind of moving.
Wow. Well, good luck with that. Good luck with the funding. Good luck with the patent application.
Oh, yes. That's already in. We'll hear more about that in April, I think. And I'm excited about that. We'll see if anybody's interested in licensing that.
Sure. What did you have any, were there any challenges or was it difficult to get people in the cranberry industry to first say, sure, we'll let you take a look at this. Come on board. Or how did that process go?
Sure. Initially, I wasn't even thinking about the cranberry industry as much as I was thinking about the grape industry. I wanted to work with the wineries.
Oh, okay.
And my thought process there was that most of our cranberry industry folks are in big co-ops or they're multi-conglomerates or, you know, they're giant companies. I thought it would be harder to get them to call me back.
Mm-hmm.
But the vineyards and the wineries tend to be family owned.
Yeah.
And the people at Wollersheim mm-hmm. were very, very kind in talking to me and became clear that they had developed multiple ways over the years to make money on their waste. And
oh.
they weren't really interested in a new way. And
yeah.
that was great for me because it actually redirected me to talk to the cranberry oh. producers more.
Yeah.
Initially, Mariani up in Wisconsin Rapids and Badger State were very keen to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
However, you know, Ocean Spray, we have a facility here in Kenosha.
Yeah.
I can't get them to call me back for anything. They
oh my
don't
God.
Want to have anything to do with this.
So Ocean Spray, if you're listening,
yeah.
call Franny Mann.
Yeah, they are a big company, though, and
yeah.
maybe they've decided that you know, they don't need help from little old us. But
yeah.
The other companies saw an opportunity, and after I initially called them, they invited me up, and I toured the great state of Wisconsin. You know, I was up in the Northwest Corridor where all
sure.
these cranberry bogs are, and they were so kind. They took me on tours of their facilities. They talked about, you know, future plans. They were more than excited to have these conversations and have these ideas. They gave me more samples than I know what to do with. I still
wow.
have freezers of samples that
wow.
I haven't used yet.
Yeah.
But they were great once I was brave enough to reach out to them. So really, I was the limiting factor there. I didn't think that they would want to talk to me. And I got a little bit of confidence boost from how excited they were to partner with us.
Sure. So you mentioned the grape industry and I think it's fair to say that the wine industry in Wisconsin continues to grow.
It's true.
You know, when
Definitely.
You think back maybe a couple of 20 years ago or so, and maybe a couple things were going on, but a lot more trying to grow things here, grapes that will be successful or survive. It's surviving the winter.
Yeah, we call those cold hardy grapes.
Yeah.
And so the universities are actually very focused on breeding new cold hardy grapes for mm-hmm. the producers in the upper Midwest.
Mm-hmm. And so other fruits that Wisconsin produces,
mm-hmm.
One being the tart cherry,
yes.
and anyone who's you know who's traveled around Door County knows that, okay, come summertime, everything's a cherry
yes.
in Door County, you know, cherry this, cherry that. But is that also an industry that you're looking at exploring this with?
Yes. We didn't have any partners that were interested in that directly.
Hmm.
Many of the fruit processors do tart cherry work as well, and they also do blueberry work.
Oh.
And really, they just have tons of cranberry waste. So right now, we spent the most amount of time trying to optimize the system for the waste that they already have.
Mm-hmm.
But several of them asked me while I was out there, you know, could you adapt this to a different berry if we decided to spend more energy and resources in
yeah.
other markets?
Yeah.
We did actually test for tart cherries, and
oh.
we were able to optimize that system. Tart cherries are naturally less rich in anthocyanins. You can see that in it's just there's less of it in the peels, I should say. There's lots of it in the juice. So if you compare cranberry juice and tart cherry juice is very, very dark. And it's almost
oh, yeah,
a little bit
right.
thicker.
Yeah, right.
And that's
right.
because the anthocyanins tend to just be a little bit more water soluble in the cherries. There's more water in cherries. They extract a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So our optimization process didn't get us quite as good of results, but we definitely already have one. And if we find that our producers want to use a system like the one we developed to extract from their tart cherry waste, we're ready to go. We're good
sure.
to go.
Sure.
And one of the things we're trying now is just with a little bit of blueberries. Because they did indicate that they were interested in getting into that market. So, again, if we have the solution for them when they build that market,
mm-hmm.
then we'll be there for them.
Wow, interesting. We're kind of shifting gears a little bit here, and we're talking with Dr. Franny Mann, who's assistant professor of chemistry here at UW-Parkside. The academic programs at UW-Parkside and you've been here for 4 years?
This is my third year.
Third year. The academic programs, especially on the graduate side, the master's programs, have grown amazingly fast.
Mm-hmm.
And you're involved with the Master of Science in Applied biotechnology. And tell us a little bit about how that program came into being.
Sure. So we work with UW Extended Campus, and mm-hmm. they came to us and said, we think that there are people who are currently employed in the biotechnology industry. So that would be not just straight biotech, but any type of food processing, much like my expertise. Mm-hmm. And then also pharmaceutical development. So if you think about, you know, the North Chicago corridor, we have a lot of contacts at Abbott and AbbVie and Baxter.
Yeah, yeah.
Those companies, we think that there are people there who are kind of stuck because they need that master's credential to move up into any type of promotion. Mm-hmm. And they can't afford to not work anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't go back to school. And so this program was developed actually in conjunction with 12 industry partners across our state, Illinois, and Iowa, who came together and told us exactly what they want mm-hmm. for their employees to be able to get training in while still on the job. So this program has 11 courses, 31 credits, and it's all online. It's mm-hmm. designed for working adults who are already working in the biotech or pharma industry. Mm-hmm. And these people are going to be getting a breadth of skills mm-hmm. that their employers, that the folks who served on our advisory board and our development board said that they really need their employees to have. And these would be, you know, very broad understandings of how the market works, how regulation works, having very broad understanding of technology. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting to sit down with this, you know, 12 group panel, because we initially said, well, don't you want people who have a different type of master's degree, like a MBA, right? There's a big name mm-hmm. to having an MBA. And mm-hmm. they said, you know, those people typically don't know enough science. So we need people with a science background we'll train them in not just the management side, but all of the different things about the science that maybe the average MBA doesn't know or would have to work really hard to try to understand. Those people generally understand it a little bit better. But the management and the regulation and the scope, we can teach them. And that's what we really want them to teach. So we've developed this and we are implementing it in January. We already have one admitted student for Parkside. I think we have about 15 across the program, several partners across the state. And maybe the most exciting thing, the thing I'm most excited about, is just the caliber of people who are teaching for this program. We have several people who have biotech experience who work in the UW system. So people like myself who are interested in ground up research where we are trying to get intellectual property built from the universities. But we also have people who have spent years in the biotech industry teaching for our program. So we have kind of this amazing collaboration of industry and academic knowledge building the skill set that the industry asked for.
From a faculty standpoint, how is teaching an online course different, the same, than teaching an in-class course? What is that from your perspective as the person doing the sharing that knowledge?
In some ways, it's much more difficult to teach an online course. And that's because in the classroom, if I'm interacting with my students, I can tell where you're having difficulty. I can watch your facial expressions. You can raise your hand in real time and ask me a question and hold me accountable until the moment it clicks for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in an online course, many of these things have to be built ahead of time. And it's harder for me to judge whether you understand them.
Yeah.
And it's also harder to build up a rapport with your students. So I'm just a voice on the other side of a computer, right?
Mm-hmm,
and my students, it's hard to trust a voice. This you know, person that you might see me in a video snippet, but really I'm not heavily present like I am in a classroom.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more planning. It's a little bit less flexible, but I really do see the value in it for, again, working adults.
Yeah, right,
they can't possibly come in and spend 3 hours during their work week in class. They need to be able to do this in the evenings and weekends. And actually, Extended Campus tells us that we're looking at sometime between 7 p.m. and 11 p.m. That's when these students are logging in and doing their work, and then on the weekends.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but I like to be home with my family between 7 and 11 p.m. So it would be hard for me to teach a class that meets their needs if it wasn't online.
Right. Right. What about that from the student perspective? Do you see, I'm pretty sure I would be a really bad, well, I was not that good of student either way, but I would be a really bad online student because I can procrastinate with the best of them. And it would seem like you have to be able to be self-motivated to do an online course, yes?
I think that there's some truth to that, and it's actually very good to know that about yourself because then you know that maybe the online course is not necessarily the type of course that you'll do the best in.
Mm-hmm.
But what I can say about these extended campus hosted classes is that they really coach the faculty, including myself, to provide structure so that you find out, you know, early on that this is not working for you. Or maybe you find out that if I just provide you enough structure, if I say, you know, every week, these are two due dates you have to hit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's maybe not the highest stakes, you know, you just have to do some homework and turn it in, but you don't get to procrastinate the entire class until, you know, 3 days before the class ends.
Right.
Every week you need to be logging in and checking in and completing things. And I can see that. So, you know, if I see that you haven't logged in 2 weeks, I reach out to you and I say, hey, can I help you?
Yeah.
Do we need to talk about maybe restarting this class for you? Or is this just not something you were interested in?
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that, you know, the online classes get kind of that bad reputation because it's all on you. But here we provide a lot of resources and coaching and check-ins for our students. So it's scaffolded is the word we use. It's scaffolded so that we keep you a little bit more accountable to yourself and to us.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that means that you do better. And actually, the track record of Extended Campus is that these classes, they do better in these classes.
Yeah. What about I would think it'd be pretty interesting to know that the market or the opportunity for a student to engage in this program doesn't matter whether the student's in Wisconsin, Colorado,
yes,
wherever that student may be, if they look at that program and say, oh, this is something that I'm interested in or I need this, they can get on board with it.
Right. And we actually do have several admitted international students right now.
Oh, okay.
We have students from California, many from Wisconsin and Illinois, because, of course, that's the market in which the UW system is really recognized.
Yeah, yeah.
But we are starting to see, even just with our fledgling, brand new program, that we're getting people across the states and internationally. I'm excited to see those people interact in the classroom, in this online classroom, because the things that we take for granted in terms of regulation in the U.S. aren't necessarily true in other countries. Mm. So there will be a lot of...
How so? What's an example of that?
For example, the food additive and cosmetic additive industry, it's regulated very harshly in Europe. And in the U.S., we tend to be a little bit more lax. We allow specific additives that have not been shown to be too dangerous or have what we call very high toxic dose. You would have to take a lot of it to see any adverse effect.
Okay.
We still allow those in our food and in our home goods and cosmetics. The European Union has really cracked down on some of those things.
Mm.
So that part of the regulation, but also the process of getting things approved is very, very arduous in the U.S. And maybe because you have to demonstrate safety across all these steps because we don't regulate the ingredients so much. And in the EU, it tends to be a little bit faster. And so things like that will really lead to a more enriched conversation, I think. And we do really give the opportunity for the students to discuss these types of issues. I teach a techniques class, and even in our scientific techniques class, we talk about the difference in regulatory systems here versus internationally. And we talk about the need for specific tests in the U.S. as opposed to maybe India or China, where they don't do as much testing.
Mm-hmm. Are the students that are in one of your online classes, do they know, oh, here are the other students that are in, or is it just more just the one-on-one, or how does that work?
I think in all of our classes, we're encouraged to build some sort of community opportunity.
Oh, okay.
The way that I do it is involving discussion boards. We designed actually a debate, so the students have to participate in this debate in which they form an initial opinion and then try to sway each other.
Uh-huh.
So they get to know each other a little bit in that way.
Yeah.
We also give them the opportunity to introduce themselves early in the semester. So we ask them to post a little, you know, blurb about themselves, much like a press release or something, a little tiny bit of information. They don't have to put a picture up, but they're welcome to, and it really helps us build that community a little bit more.
Sure.
It also helps us, you know, if you are in the job market and you really hope to get in at one company and your classmates in at that company, maybe those connections can be made. And so I'm really excited to see not only the courses, but kind of this LinkedIn network I think we can build around this program, where suddenly we have contacts all over in all of these different countries and all of these different companies in these countries worldwide, in which suddenly you have a friend or someone you've worked with and they can vouch for you. It's going to be really great from a networking perspective.
Well, that sounds really exciting. That was something I hadn't thought about, was the community and saying, oh, I know someone in my class who's in California or Switzerland or wherever that may be. We've been talking with Dr. Franny Mann, who's assistant professor of chemistry here at UW Parkside. Dr. Mann, thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate that.
Of course, and
good luck, continued success with your research and working with the cranberry industry here in Wisconsin. And that certainly is an interesting initiative.
Thank you so much.
To hear past editions of Parkside Today, please visit uwp.edu/Parkside Today. Thanks for listening, everyone.